Welcome to The Landscape, a podcast to shed light on the people, programs, and businesses that are changing the landscape for individuals with any type of disability. I'm your host, Nave Eldar. Today's guest is Gabriel Meyer of Brazil. Gabriel has worked with the Paralympics, United Nations, and was a co-founder of Brazil's Yureci Sports and Culture for the Blind, which has been recognized by the likes of FIFA football. And he has studied and worked all over the world, with civil rights being at the root of what he does. Gary Pate was the executive producer of this episode. I say that jokingly, but this is the third episode that I've done based on connections made by Gary, who, if you remember, did an episode on the U.S. Paralympic wheelchair rugby team back in season one. So thank you, Gary, as always, for connecting me with such amazing people and programs. But this episode starts with Gabriel explaining how he first got involved with blind soccer, also called five-a-side soccer.
Just before university, I had two friends who are blind, and they were playing at the time at the Rio de Janeiro team of blind football. And once I went to the university, I started studying at night, so I had basically the whole day free. I didn't work at the time. And I was inviting them to do things, and they were busy with lots of things. And they at some point, they said, look, if you have nothing to do and you want to hang out with us, you could come to the trainings. You could be the goalkeeper on five-a-side soccer. And then you could help, because we're needing one goalkeeper. We can't have the full match on the trainings. So you can hang out with us there. And very soon, it was clear that I was a good friend, but not a good goalkeeper. And as I was studying to be a PE teacher, I started to help the coach to train the other goalkeepers, and then to do more and more, but didn't start from a motivation. And this, I think, that was pretty important to me, because I didn't look at people with disabilities and say, oh, I want to work with them, I want to support them, or anything like this. It started going to play ball with my friends.
Right.
And from that point, I think that the perspective was not that I'm sighted, so I could help them or give something. Actually, it only happened because I was the worst player in the pitch. And so it kind of turned the perspective. And right. So, yeah, it wasn't an inspiration or pursuit. It happened.
And then where did you go from there? Because I know eventually you ended up going abroad. So what happened between that period of time to you going abroad the first time?
Well, this institute that I worked is one of the biggest in Brazil for the blind. And they would organize some competitions, some sports tournaments from time to time with the National Organization of Sports for the Blind. So I started helping to organize chess tournaments. And I'm a bit geeky, so at the time, 2001, 2002, I had nothing much to do to organize a chess tournament, because it's exciting, but in a slow pace. So I started to upload the results live online. And this was kind of a breakthrough when everybody started to talk about the guy who was putting the scores live. And at the time, you couldn't access scores. And then the national organization started to pay attention to me, inviting me to participate in some competitions, some international competitions. And in 2004, they invited me to go to a week-long exchange in Greece on blind soccer. So I went there. At some point, Brazil had to do a training for everyone. And the guys from England, one of the students, he really liked, and he said that was the best training he did to that point, playing his football, and spoke to his teacher, who invited me to go to England for an year. So I was a volunteer at the Royal National College for the Blind, and also an assistant coach of the national blind football team. So I spent 2005 to 2006 in England, and then life went really in a different direction that clearly I didn't expect to.
So how surprising was that? I mean, you go to England, right? So now you're just speaking a foreign language in the center of Europe, kind of like, you know, this major, major city. And all of a sudden they're like, can you assist us on our Paralympic team? Were you like in shock? Were you, you know, were you like really confident in yourself? What was that like?
Well, I think that I had the benefit of the ignorance of the youth. So I didn't know really much about what to expect. I knew that was a better opportunity than what I had in Brazil. And actually it was the opposite, because I'm from Rio de Janeiro, which is one of the biggest cities in the world. And I moved to Hereford, which is a small town in England, gotcha. In the countryside, in the border with Wales. And it was really challenging sometimes, like, yeah, I wasn't brave enough to pick up the phone because I didn't know if I could speak to someone in English without seeing the person, so I would only text people. But it gave me the perspective that I went to play ball with my friends, but their coach, he was a world champion in the sport. And seeing other people with a longer career in the sport and playing in with sport for the blind, sometimes with less knowledge than I had, it gave me the perspective that I was very fortunate to be in the right place with a right coach, to have opportunities to see world championships, to see things live. That gave me some experience. At the time, I was 21 years old. I was playing and was in the same ball game of people with 30 odd years or 40 years old. So this was challenging at some times because there was lots of about life that they had I didn't, maturity and knowing how to cope with situations, but was really much about being a sponge and understanding the differences of the work in here and in England, how disabilities, the resources that you have in different scales in the north of the globe and in the south, and how the attitude changes as well, and policies, and to be able to navigate in two worlds, and also to see differences and also some similarities, or sometimes things that here in Brazil are better done than in developed countries. I think this was the biggest takeover that I had from this year, to see that they had a huge structure, but myself as a professional, I could see myself much more equipped to adapt, to react to problems and solve problems than my colleagues in England had at the time. So getting to know that there's no perfect place enough, you can get good things from here and there. And myself personally trying to get the best of both worlds to do my path. This, I think, was the best from this year.
So I actually want to talk about that for a second. So I lived in Israel for almost 7 years, right? And I'm coming from the United States. So there was a huge culture difference. And England to Brazil is a huge culture difference, right? So it's exactly like you said, that there's pluses and minuses on both sides. So what were some of the bigger differences that you had to adapt to? And what were some things from the way they ran things or from their culture that you said, I want to take this and bring it to my work everywhere, including Brazil?
Well, I think that there was lots of having the mindset of giving the best structure for the work. So let's say we would travel with my team here in Brazil with two kids or three kids to a tournament and was okay. We would play 5-7 games. You use it twice and it's okay. They would travel with 14 because every game, if they needed to change, use kit one and kit two, they would have. And they would plan to have the best available professionals, equipment, structure, catering. And in here, not always. I think that a lot, like we're good on doing the essential and leaving it to whatever happens in the last minutes. Which is good that you have creative solutions. But yeah, sometimes you lack structure, you lack resources. So yeah, I try to spend more time on planning and forecasting all the resources that will be needed to a project, to trip or whatever. And this was a big learning because, yeah, as we say in Brazil, I don't know if you have this saying in English, but sometimes I felt that they were trying to kill a fly with a cannonball. So,
okay.
So yeah, but sometimes it's important as well. So you don't have anything, any distractions. You just do your things because, yeah, you all the problems, all the flies have been killed.
And then my second question to that is, I'm sure you've probably seen the movie Rising Phoenix.
Yeah.
Have you seen that on the Paralympics? And so that really highlighted, ironically, we had the Paralympic Games in England. And then 4 years later, the Paralympic Games were in Brazil. And it was two very, very different levels of respect that were given to the games, to put it, you know, mm-hmm. politely. So yeah. Culturally, what is the culture like in Brazil for the disability community in general? You know, not even compared to anywhere else, just from, because you've lived all over and you've definitely traveled all over. But so when you look at Brazil, like, where are you guys at as far as like disability rights and support?
Well, I think that Brazil has, if we think about with the Paralympic perspective, we have a Paralympic committee that is very well funded and does not reflect the status of Paralympic clubs and Paralympic movement in the country. Neither does reflect the status of persons with disabilities in the country. So I think that here in Brazil, people will have a really good attitude with someone who has a disability. People will go out of their line and change their, like you can see quite often, someone just stopping the car, parking the car, just to help someone to cross the street. You see this from time to time, you see it online. But you won't see the same person spending some money to put a ramp in his business if he's not obliged. So we say that the good attitude in here ends to the moment that you have to reach your pocket. And in a very, in a medical perspective of disability, you have to help. And this person who stops the car, he feels good because he stopped the car, but he wouldn't see this as an obligation on in his business that he has to have a ramp or a braille menu. So we have this particularity in here. I think that through the games, the Paralympians have a really, really good public perception in Brazil. I think that leaving things to the last minute and sorting it somehow is something that we do. So watching the movie, I don't think that it was so close to not happening, because somehow from somewhere they would find some money, because we do like this, because no one would afford to be the politician or the person who didn't sign for the guys with disabilities to have their games. So this would be a political and a social cost, really, a really big cost for whoever. So of course, Andrew and the guys, they had to do the pressure, which is kind of part of the show. But in the last minute, it is sorted out. You don't know where is the money coming from. You don't know who is doing this, but somehow has to be done and will be done. So, which is a pity, because sometimes this is the kind of the fly that would be great to have the resources planned before and not having this stress. Because, yeah, it was something that is well portrayed in the movie, but if you're like walking around the city and my friends, my colleagues speaking to me, no one was really talking about the possibility of it not happening. It was very close of people who were very engaged with it. Because everyone knew that, okay, it will happen. We don't know how, but it will. Yeah, we're not really good on reaching the pocket as a business owner or as a country organizing a Paralympic Games.
And so you returned from England, and then you were a co-founder of a sports group. Can you tell us about that organization that you co-founded?
Yeah, I can talk a lot about Uresi, so please stop me. Yeah,
Uresi. Yes, give us the name again.
Ureci, U-R-E-C-E. Okay. So at this blind institute that we were when I was at the university, we had the players. This institute was from the federal government, and it was some, like, they have a hospital, they have a school, teachers training and everything, and rehabilitation, and also they have the sports teams. And the teams were not the priority, which much reason. So as we were doing the sports, we wanted to go to more tournaments to have better resources. We wanted to have our own team. So yeah, I was part of an entrepreneurship course. I went asking how to register an organization which we needed to have to be in the tournaments. And I went out of this entrepreneurship course with a business plan, which I had no idea of what was either. But it gave us a really good path, being this course with loads of for-profit companies that were starting, many startups. We would talk, so we'll do this and you give us money. And they would say, no, we don't have. It's not that because we're for-profit that we have all the money that you don't have. And we started to understand very early that was not because we did something cool that people would invest in us. So we start with this mindset. We understood the power that we'd have with communications. So before having the first team, the first ball, the first training session, we had at the time the best website on sports for the blind in Brazil. So we received criticism from the national sports organization saying that we were talking too much and doing nothing because people wouldn't reach their website. And through this, we could build our reputation and start the work. At the time was to be the best team. We wanted to win everything, to be professionalized, like the coaches. Now we graduated, so we wanted to work in the field. So we wanted to be paid for it. And the players, they wanted to have sponsors, and we couldn't do it in the federal institute. So once we started to do it, the learning curve was way steeper than that. But we have our Paralympians, we have a few Paralympic medals. But we had a really big turning point in 2009 when we did the first, like, two things happened in 2009. We did the first female blind soccer team in Brazil. So it was a really cool project. Okay. We traveled with the girls, like, they learned in 3 months how to play. They went to Germany and they became champions of the tournament. And then we came back with sponsorship to build new teams. And we went to 3 regions of the country to train and to have girls playing. And then the National Federation played against it. And the project never took off. Then we started to learn that besides the prejudice about disability, girls were also suffering from double prejudice on gender and disability.
Right.
So we started to understand that perhaps we could do more than just get the medals. Like a project like this, we could talk about gender, about so many issues that the girls also faced, not only disabilities. And also at the same year, Rio was awarded with the Paralympic Games. So tons of money started to be invested in elite athletes. So we couldn't compete to have the best athletes, but we could compete to have a different perspective on sport. So with Ureci, we started to be part of the Sports for Social Change Network here in Brazil. It's a network of the biggest NGOs on sports and for social change. A couple of years later, I was invited to be on the board of this association and steering board. So I was not only looking about disability anymore, because as a board member, we had to think about gender, about race, about age, and so many aspects of inclusion. In this same sense, working with human rights through sports, we became part of the social projects of the FIFA Foundation. So we implemented a project for FIFA at the World Cup, and we started to work with international governments. So I went in 2014 to USA to do a State Department exchange program, a leadership program that was very instrumental for my development and networking and skills. But we had still one big dream, that was to have our own facilities. That we had the goal on the new, on the revised business plan to achieve in 2023. And way earlier, in the wake of the Paralympic Games 2016, we founded our own sports court in Nova Iguaçu, which is outside Rio in the greater Rio area. So it's a fully official blind futsal court that in a very poor area of the state, and that we can now reach people that further away, not the best phrase construction, but they were really far away from the original dream of RESI, of having the best athletes. But also in the beginning, it was a group of friends. And now we have some kids, I don't know, 7 years old, and like they have a sense of belonging, of receiving the kids from RESI, of being part of a program, of having a reason to go out of home and receiving resources and other references. And I'm not on the daily life of RESI anymore, but it's really beautiful to see that right now RESI is not what I was dreaming of. It's not what I left in 2016. Because right. For many people now, it's something new that I can't completely say, because it's an organization that is evolving and is way bigger than any of the founder members. So this is, if you think that, yeah, we were so young when we did that, I was 22, and people, like, the best advice that we had was to close it before we had debt. So yeah, to see that we have a strong work and changing lives. Okay, not changing lives, but giving tools for people to, more resources for people to change life, their lives. So right. To see that is pretty amazing. And I'm really holding myself not to speak too much about RESI, because it's because it's really, I think it's really beautiful how we managed to speak about disability, but never fundraising or positioning ourselves as a disability organization that needed support in a medical model of disability. We could clearly show how professional we were, how we were really good in what we did, and how the budget wouldn't close itself, because the world it is how it is. But we're doing selling braille menus to be a social business and be more sustainable. We had this and that, and if someone supported us, we could pretty much guarantee that we would have spontaneous media appearance, and they would have sometimes tax rebate or something like this that we did. So it was never a donation, because people wanted to help the blind. We always were very conscious not to replicate this perspective that is very present in Brazil, that a blind person should be in the corner of the street begging for money. We, as an organization, right. We would go without a sponsorship to a tournament instead of having a penny given for that. So we always could sell ourselves, and not help it to sell better the organization, but I think the message that we sent is that it's a very positive one, that it's not because we are an organization for disabilities or persons with disabilities that we should accept anything, and we can be badasses sometimes as well. So
that's awesome. I just wanted to, you spoke about it, but I wanted to emphasize to my listeners that this organization that you helped found was recognized by the United Nations by the Corporate Social Responsibility Program of FIFA, which is unbelievable, and the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. And so you got a lot of international recognition for this program. You also helped establish the Sports for Social Change and Street Football World Network. I believe you spoke a little bit about that. So what is that?
Yeah, not exactly on setting those networks, more on having RESI to join those. So because those networks, when we joined, they didn't have any organization of sports for people with disabilities. So it was kind of saying, hey guys, I guess that what we do, it's also changing lives, and also it's sports, and it's also football. It's not soccer, but it's kind of, I think that you should look at us. So it was right. This part of convincing those networks that had no representation of disability at the time that we belonged there. So the Street Football Network is a global network of NGOs working with sport as a tool for social change. It's amazing. I think that anyone interested in sports for social change, just having a look about on the projects in the website, you can just travel the world seeing the best examples of sport being used in the right way. And the Brazilian Sports for Social Change Network is a younger organization. I had a bigger role in there as I was part of the board. It's basically an organization that sometimes you have companies and big Olympic committee or soccer clubs or professional sports clubs that are well represented. They have the best lawyers, the best professionals. And you as a sector trying to do sports for social change, you have challenges that are impossible for you as an individual or one organization to tackle. So one of the main things that I was part of, we have a tax rebate law in Brazil that if you have a sports project, instead of paying the taxes, X amount of taxes, a company can invest in this project. So they basically don't spend the money that was going to taxes anyway, but they invest in this project and they can have their logo and promote it. So it's the government incentivizing sports. But there were some regulations on that made it impossible for small organizations to reach this money, because it was a law that was made listing the lawyers from the professional clubs, the lawyers from the Olympic Committee. So us as a sector working together to discuss and sit together, say, yeah, like each one of us, we cannot pay one of the best lawyers, but all of us together, we can get funding and part of this funding to be used to have this lawyer, making it possible for us to reach this fund and also exchange knowledge. So last year I was working with UNDESA for 3 months. So now I'll probably in the first semester do some presentation for all of them about opportunities that I learned that are possible for organizations to access through the UN system. So it's you have the knowledge exchange as I'm doing, but also advocacy and lobbying to try to have the laws and the regulations and governments to support our work, because we cannot do without the government as a sector, but it has to be done in a nice way. Again, if you ask about the guy who went to play ball with the friends, I would never, ever imagine that I would be discussing regulations of tax, of laws, or later on studying international documents on human rights. I didn't know that I was doing human rights till 2009, 2010. When I couldn't get the female blind soccer project ahead, then I started to speak to some people. I said, look, this is gender, it's a gender issue, this is a human right, read this, read that. And then I started to understand. So this process, being in a network and knowing that most of the challenges that I face as an organization or an individual, I'm not the first one to do. I'm not that special to be the first one to face something. So I truly believe in this work, in networks and exchanging knowledge as we're doing here, and getting to know a bit about, like I was listening to other episodes and knowing how the sector is going there. And there's other podcasts as well nowadays that you can just have and understand that you're not that special. That people had good solutions to problems that can help you. So I think that with the networks, this was the main thing.
So you're very humble because you say you're not that special. You're right. Nobody has invented the wheel in a very long time. But the things that you've accomplished and helped establish have been outstanding. There aren't many people that work for a foreign Paralympic team for the United Nations, you know, create their own sports network. So you're doing some amazing things. One of the things that you touched on very briefly earlier was that you also had been, I can't remember how it happened, but you had been given a mentor here in the United States. So what was that mentorship program? How did you get into it? And then what did you learn by that?
In 2014, in the State Department, they have a sports for community program. They were identifying sports leaders for in sports for social change here in Brazil, and it was an open application process. And I applied to be part of it. And they would match you we would have a few days in DC, having leadership training and social media training and concepts about social sports and how some programs were doing in there, and then we would go for 3 weeks to be with a mentor. So I was assigned with Mark Lucas from USABA, the U.S. Association of Blind Athletes, in Colorado Springs. So mm-hmm. I was there for 3 weeks, working at the USABA offices and living, and I was hosted at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in there. So I was kind of diving in the U.S. Olympism. At the time, I had never lived for a period of time in such facilities. So it was great to walk after work from wrestling to swimming and then go to the different athletes or then judo, just see some of the best athletes in the world all around and hanging out at dinner and asking about what I was doing there and what was my thing. So this experience was very instrumental, I think, to understand the mentality. I think that the way that we trained to treat the athletes is very different from what happens in Colorado Springs. In short, I think that perhaps what struck me the most, we are pretty much used to nurse the athletes, so take care of what they are eating or take care if they are going to sleep at time or not. And so this you kind of learn in the university, that is a role that you have as a coach. And for me, it was shocking that they could go to the dining room and they would have like free ice cream, free sodas, and they could get all the food they wanted. And I was like, okay, how does it work? And they were saying, yeah, if we are overweight, we are cut. So we know that.
Oh, wow.
So we have all of these, and sometimes we should have treats because we spend lots of calories, but if we put on weight, we are cut from the program, we are cut from the national team, and we know that someone wants our place. So giving the responsibility to the athletes, this was something right. that was a big learning for me. When I went there, I was eager to support U.S. to have their blind soccer team. And was another learning that I had was that Mark Lucas, my mentor, said, look, we have a strategic plan. We do goalball at the Paralympics, and we need the medals in goalball so we get our funding. So we're not doing football because it's out of our bullseye. Eventually,
okay,
we may do it, but it's not our goal because we would need 15, 20 years to make it happen in this level. So we can't mm-hmm. afford to go out of the way. So, of course, now the games are going to be in US, so you'll have a slot and probably will have a team. So now this is getting traction. So in my post-exchange project, I was doing a few videos on teaching coaches how to do the sport. But yeah, so there are differences. I think that in Brazil, probably one manager would say, look, we have this guy skilled in this sport that we don't have. Let's organize something. Let's kick off in here and then we see how it goes. But somehow we won't miss this opportunity. So I'm not sure if I completely agree that opportunities should be missed but I surely appreciate how the leadership can stick to the plan. And this was a learning to me.
Right.
I like to be in those different situations and see different management styles and perspectives on sports and everything. So, yeah, those kinds of learning that I think that are very rich that I have.
Did I read correctly that you also coached the first blind skier in Brazil?
It's the blind skier was Marcos, a good friend of mine. He's a YouTuber here in Brazil. He was one of the two guys who studied with me. So I went to do my master's in Belgium and the Czech Republic. And through my master's, I was doing the first workshops on blind soccer in the Czech Republic. So, and my promoter of my studies, he was the coach of the Czech team of ski for the blind. And then I was speaking to him saying, look, if I'm going to teach you how to do soccer, maybe we should have one of our athletes to come over to the Czech Republic to be the first Brazilian to do ski. And he said, oh, this would be amazing. Okay. So he went there. So we had a ski camp for all the students of my class and some of the graduation in the Czech Republic. And Marcos was there. So I was together with him. Like, I wasn't fully the coach because, of course, uh-huh. I wasn't a skier myself at the time. But I was working closely with the Czech student that was with him. So she would show the exercises. She was learning how to work with blind athletes. She has loads of knowledge on ski. So we were both mm-hmm. co-coaching him. And was really impressive because with the skills that he has from playing football, playing soccer, the learning curve was very, very steep. And everyone was were really impressed with him. So, like, they were using, like, the first day to teach the guys how to fall and don't be afraid of falling in the snow. And it was quite funny mm-hmm. because they were saying, okay, Marcos, now you need to fall. He was like, fall, like, the season. No, just fall on the ground. Like, just fall? Yeah, so he just jumped. Oh, you're not afraid? No, I play football. This is nothing.
Right.
And they were okay, so maybe we should go for tomorrow. So he was getting things done really. And of course, he had lots of body awareness that helped it a lot. So yeah, it was a really mm-hmm. good experience. But the most important thing, like, he's not in a Paralympic level or he's not with his aspiration. But it is good that now, like, I've been in many presentations with him, that he would just go to the audience and ask, okay, in here, in this room, and you would have like 100 people, how many of you had the opportunity to ski in the snow? You would have like one or two. And he said, yeah, I had. So it's not about the disability. I had the means. I had the snow, right. So I could ski. You didn't have the snow, so you couldn't. So it's not that I'm blind, I can't do things. So it's all about having the right. means, the tools, the accessibility. So this was something that I think was the most important part of the project, was coming back here to show that through this project that the barrier shouldn't be the disability, but in this case right. was the lack of snow and skis. So when you talk this, like, it, of course you are much way more familiar with the concept, but every time that we had this discussion, you could see the Eureka moments in the audience because people mm-hmm. literally never thought about disability in this perspective. So this aspect on how it's used here in Brazil, I think this is the most important aspect of this project, in my opinion.
That's a great story. And it's also hilarious how he managed to get to learn how to ski. So yeah. You just got back from doing some work with the United Nations. You yes. just got back in Brazil. Where were you in? Were you in Ireland?
Well, I've been after the games. We uh-huh. built the court that I was speaking before, and I was feeling that at the moment I was many times being portrayed in news and things that we did in stories as someone that was doing something for the blind, not that was part of a team. This was not making me super happy. I was feeling that would be good to have someone with disabilities in this position for a better representation. I don't know if we were sending the right messages. I was also, in a personal note, wishing to have the work in a more global context, not with the 40, 80 persons that Udesa was directly reaching. So I applied for the UNESCO chair in Tralee in Ireland. So I was working for 2 years in there before. So in there, I was working with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, international documents, WHO, and all sorts of international organizations, saying what they wrote and trying to advocate to have disabilities included and sports for people with disabilities included in those documents and perspectives, trying to advocate on how those documents and the sustainable development goals, how they were also speaking about sports, physical activity, and especially for people with disabilities. So we're 2 years diving into that. So we're kind of from working in this microcosmos of Udesa, being teleported to thinking globally, and which was a challenge because it's a different time, different language, not only English, but also kind of English that he used to use was very far away from that. So it took me a while to understand that what I was doing. Once I did so, it was time to come back to Brazil. Mm-hmm. And I was for almost 2 years back to Brazil. And in the end of last year, I was invited to be a consultant to the United Nations DESA department. So yeah, I was working remotely because of COVID and everything. But again, trying to think about with COVID and all this moment, how the next steps for the field of sports and physical activity should go to make sure that no one is left behind, how we can use digital technologies in a way that we leave no one behind, but not only persons with disabilities that may have accessibility challenges, but if you think in a very underprivileged community that won't have internet access, how you can reach them to encourage people to be more active, to do more sports. So it was a huge challenge to think, like to set a meeting. You have to think about parity in gender, in geographical location, in sectors, because you have to listen to governments, to public sector, international organizations, NGOs, individuals, how you mix and match people to do that. Gave me a perspective that, again, I would never imagine that I would have one day about our sector, about and our sector in disabilities, in sports. It's great to see that the challenges are big, but there's a lot of great things being done. So, I remember there was a week that I was trying to find projects and people to join an event in Africa and Asia. So I was diving in problems that were being solved that I would never think about them as problems. It's pretty amazing that I had this opportunity. What, of course, was a job, but for me it was way more a learning, and I know that people say it all the time, but truly, like, I was paid to dive into the sector that I work, to understand challenges that I would never stop to think about or to dive into, giving me making me way more equipped to think about challenges in here and elsewhere. So yeah, this is the path and where I am right now, which sometimes is tricky to find a job in here because those discussions are not being done everywhere. So to find a job, sometimes you need a very specific kind of employer. But on the other hand, I don't know if I would be happier doing something regular or what I imagined that I was going to do when I joined the university.
I have to say, I laughed because I know your resume, which we're nearing the end of this episode, and people have heard your resume as well, which is unbelievable, right? You've worked in, you know, you've been in the United States, South America, Europe, you know, working for the United Nations, just touching every corner of the globe. But like the first thing on your resume is PE teacher, right? And so for us Americans, you know, we think of like a gym teacher. It's like, you know, your middle school gym teacher, not somebody who's working for the United Nations, helping to you know, fighting for civil rights and things. So that's amazing. Where do you see yourself? Because you're so forward thinking, it seems like you're all that's one of your skills. I mean, I hope you realize that. Everybody else, I'm sure, realizes that one of your skills is how progressive you are in your thinking. So what are you thinking about for like the next year to 5 years?
Just before on what you touched before on my resume, I have a good friend, and you know that the good friends are telling the truth to you. And he said that I'm like the duck, the animal, the duck, because the duck can fly, the duck can swim, and the duck can run. He won't do anything right, but he does a bit of everything. So yeah, often I feel like that. But when I was saying that I would never imagine when I started, I would see myself as a soccer coach, and I would never imagine. But in the same way, I'm proud to be a teacher, and I kind of miss being a coach to being a teacher. But now back to your question. I think that now we have lots of challenges to have the world running again after vaccines and COVID being back on track. I think that there was a lot of learning for every organization, coach and professionals, on the possibilities of working remotely and having online and more a broader reach with the work. So this is something that we will be discussing soon. I think that now you won't think only about the class that is next to you. But this is also posing a big risk, because there's the digital gap, that digital divide, that can only get further and further. And there's a word that I've been, I saw many people saying that, so I am afraid of quoting the right person, but that says that if it's not good for everyone, it's not good for me. So I think that we have to think that we will adapt, we will have more resources and more tools in our toolbox to do great projects, to do more change, but it shouldn't be at the expense of some being missed out. So I think that this is a challenge. And in the same perspective, I think that more and more as a sector, we will have to think about funding what should be funded. So we have professional sports clubs and sometimes elite sports having way more funding than the grassroots sports. I know that in the US, grassroots sports are deeply rooted in volunteer work. So on how you can have it sustainable and with the best deliverables possible. Like in Brazil, we don't have this culture of volunteerism in sports. So how we can make sure that those who need the most will have the best services? Because, yeah, what would change the life of the Michael Phelps or the of the big athletes to have, I don't know, an extra 5,000. I hate to put numbers on names, but sometimes they will have more money to have the biggest contract and so on. And in a way that is not sustainable, and that more and more professional clubs will engage with grassroots and community sports. And how in this movement that is happening, you see all the major leagues are involved with social sports. I think that us working with disabilities and sports for people with disabilities, we have to make sure that we knock the doors and we show that we belong to that, to this movement, that we need resources to do our work, to have the sport for people with disabilities, having the resources and funding to be done in the right way and for everyone, not leaving anyone behind. So I think that those are the challenges that I can see as a sector in the moment. But I don't know, the world is changing so much. If you ask me the same early last year, I'm pretty sure that I would miss completely. So
right. Okay, so I always end my show with a few personal questions. So one is, I just learned before we started recording that you have your own podcast that you have, you said about 10 episodes out right now. So tell us a little bit about that. What is the theme? Who are the hosts and what's the name of it?
So the podcast is called Mundo para Esporte. I do it with two colleagues, two co-hosts. One is Ricardo. He is a PE teacher. He played a bit of wheelchair rugby himself. Before having suffering the accident, he was a judo athlete. And Leticia, she was a swimmer from the Brazilian Paralympic team. She is a Pan American medalist. And so we have a good mix of the two of them. One who is a professor, Leticia, she's an athlete. And myself, I'm very curious. So when I came back to Brazil, I like to listen to podcasts. I like to have conversations. And I don't know, this conversation that I had with you, I never had before, and I wouldn't have with a friend. So it's good to have and share those conversations. So I wanted to do it. And there's a producing agents of podcasts that was not so far from here, from home. So I knocked at their door, said, look, I know that you have a few sports podcasts. We should have one about Paralympic sports. So we did so, and they accepted. So all the tough part of it, it is mixing and getting the levels of the sound and all the technical stuff, we don't have to do, and they publish it on Spotify and all the platforms. And we do the cool part, that is just find awesome people and have cool conversations and learn things. And yeah, so I truly believe that listening to other people's conversations, you just get more knowledge. And I like podcasts, so I always dive into it. Yeah.
And then, what are two facts about Brazil that Americans wouldn't know?
Brazil is also the only country in South America speaking Portuguese. So most of Latin Americans would speak Spanish. So we don't speak Spanish in here, and our capital is not Buenos Aires. I think that many times people would say, so you're from Brazil, Buenos Aires. So no, it's Brasilia, the capital.
So do Brazilians travel to Portugal and vice versa? Do the Portuguese travel to Brazil a lot? Do you have a lot of tourists from there because of the language?
Yeah, you have a lot, and you have, like, now there's loads of Brazilians living in Portugal. Like in Rio de Janeiro, we were the capital of Brazil. So there was loads of Portuguese families went there. So you can see loads of restaurants and families. And it's like one of the biggest football clubs is from the Portuguese colony. So yeah, okay. There's this connection still nowadays is very active.
That's very cool. And I didn't know that. So look, sir, it has been fantastic speaking to you. You know, Gary Pate told me that I had to speak to you, and anything that Gary tells me, I listen to because he's so awesome. I'm super impressed, super really motivated by you. You're doing a lot of great things. I love that you think just bigger and bigger and bigger. That's something that I also try to do just in my life as well. So it was a big inspiration. So thank you for coming on the show and taking the time.
No, I would like to thank you and Gary. And it was really, I think that this moment is good to speak how I've met Gary, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And when I got his message, I'm not really really active on Facebook. And I thought, is he talking to the right person? Like, there's so long and why me? So I text him, Gary, are you sure? And then he's amazing in how...
I'm going to put lots of links in the description below, including links to videos so you can see five-a-side soccer being played. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and give a star rating if you're listening on Apple Podcast. In the next episode, I speak to Hannah Setzer, who was born with cystic hygroma, a condition that left her with hundreds of cysts growing in her head and neck. Today, Hannah is a disability advocate and fitness influencer who goes by the username of Feeding Tube Fitness. I'm excited to share this interview where you'll learn, laugh, and hopefully move a little bit more. I'll see you then.